The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
This Hedge School series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com.
Good afternoon, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland Hedge School with History Ireland editor Tommy Graham in the chair. Now, this afternoon, our topic is the life and times of Brendan O'Regan. Born in 1917 in Six Mile Bridge, Brendan's background was in hotel management and catering, working in the Family Hotel in Ennis, St. Stephen's Green Club in Dublin, and the world's first duty-free shop in Shannon Airport, where he is credited with inventing Irish coffee. More on that later. In 1959, he was appointed by Sean Lamass as the first head of the Shannon Airport Development Association, later known as the Shannon Free Airport Development Company, which stimulated the establishment not only of an industrial base here in rural Clare, but a whole new town, Shannon, where we are today. Now, despite retiring in 1977, he remained active, founding Cooperation North. But despite these achievements, since his passing in 2008, he has remained a somewhat obscure figure. Now, to rectify this lacuna, we're joined by, on the far right here, Frank Barry, Professor of International Business and Economic Development at Trinity College Business School. Immediately beside me, Uni Vronel, a lecturer in history at Mary Immaculate College, University of Limerick. On my far left, Sean Donlan, former head of the Department of Foreign Affairs and ambassador to Washington. And to my immediate left here, Brian O'Connell, who, along with Keane O'Carroll, is the author of Brendan O'Regan, Irish Innovator, Visionary, Peacetaker, a Peacemaker, published by Irish Academic Press in 2018. And finally, we're joined by Brendan's son, Andrew O'Regan, a former Assistant Registrar of Strategic Development at Carlow College, St. Patrick's. And this head school is supported by Six Mile Bridge Historical Society. Just to get us started, Una, I want to go to you just to give a bit of background here before we talk about the man himself, is the background of his family, his father, his grandfather, in fact. I mean, this is a period of demographic decline in Ireland. I mean, half of those born in Ireland emigrated. But it's also a period of the Land Acts, and, you know, certain people benefit from that. Is that part of our story here?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, if you're to think about the 19th century and the broad 19th century generally, there's a link between land and political nationalism, and that land is the basis for the nation. And so, therefore, when you think about the Land Acts from 1881 to 96, you have about £23 million sterling given by the Irish Land Commission to tenants to buy land. And they bought about 75,000 acres of land. 1903, the Windham Land Act, which gives probably the most land to tenants and the most opportunity to tenants, inducements to landlords to sell, and of course, you know, inducements to tenants to buy. And this is the highest uptake of land for any of the tenantry. But if you think about the amount of land, 30 acres was the normal farm. And when talking to Brian earlier, we spoke about Patrick, and he had 43 acres altogether. So that was out of three sections that he had bought. But one of the key things, I think, not just land, but there's politicization of the people in Ireland at the time. There's the 1872 Secret Ballot Act, but most importantly, there's the 1898 Local Government Act. And this really empowers the emerging middle classes. So people like, for example, shopkeepers, publicans, they're linked to farmers and neighbours in a spirit of kinship, but also credit. And they begin to start buying up land and creating business enterprises. And what you have, therefore, is, if you like, what's regarded as a legitimate transfer of power. And so you have a patriotic or a patriotism in doing that at the time. And that's maybe the context in which we would see this buying of land and the beginnings of enterprise.
Brian, can I just come to you then? Just talk to us a little bit about Brendan's father, James. By today's standards, it's a fairly modest piece of land. But as Una said, that was the average for the period. Just, I mean, what I'm getting at is, was there an entrepreneurial gene in the family? Metaphorically speaking, of course. Just talk to us about that, about the sort of business activity, because his father, as I understand it, diversified into timber and various other enterprises.
There were genes on both sides of the family in that his father's family, the O'Regans, his father particularly was very entrepreneurial. He was in a whole host of activities. Apart from having a pub and a shop and a general grocery, he was also, he became the agent for Fiat cars. He got involved in running services, coach services. When the First World War broke out, he got involved in producing a whole lot of materials made out of wood for pit props, for trenches, for roadways that were supplied to the British Army. But at the same time, his mother's side, the Ryans of Kilrush, were equally entrepreneurial. Two generations back, I think I was saying in the book that they were Irish-speaking and they were from a fairly very basic townland north of Kilrush. But at the time, by the start of the 20th century, they were in a whole host of activities in Kilrush. They were involved in trading goods to the agricultural sector. They even had their own boats on the Shannon Estuary. They also got involved in the reconstruction of one of the piers in Kilrush. They had their own independent facilities for importing and exporting. And they also got involved in buying, I think it was the Williams Hotel in Kilrush. So there was certainly an entrepreneurial gene on both sides of the family.
Now, how did they end up they purchasing the Old Ground Hotel? I mean, was that a pre-existing hotel or was this a ground-up operation?
It was an accident. It arose out of the car dealership in that people in Milan or Turin, where I think it was, decided that it wasn't appropriate that the car dealership for County Clare would be in a small place like 6 Mile Bridge. It had to be in the capital of the county, which was Ennis. At the time, the Old Ground Hotel was a ruin. It was shut down. But there was a site that James O'Regan thought would be ideal to have a garage. So for, I think it was £1,000, he bought the site, he bought the rooms of the hotel. And then he realised that...
So the hotel is a sideline. I mean, it's...
Hotel, when he bought it originally, he went looking for a garage.
Right.
And there was space, and it was in the centre of Ennis, and the hotel had been shut down. So he bought what he described as the ruins of the Old Ground. And then he spent a lot, multiples of that, doing up. He borrowed money to do a major restoration of the hotel, and then opened it. He opened it as a very, very upmarket hotel, and it went on and thrived. And then while that was going on, he would have taken his family to the continent to learn about how people in France run hotels.
Okay, but that's an interesting question, because foreign travel would not have been the norm for most people in Ireland at that time. I mean, so it seemed to me that's pretty crucial in Brendan's formation, that familiarity with things outside Ireland.
Yes, there was a familiarity not only going to France, but also several times going to travel to England for holidays to witness hotels in England. But certainly the visit to France was very much a learning exercise for the family.
Now, what age was Brendan then when he got involved in the family business in the hotel? I mean, you know, where did his formal education end at that stage?
The ambition for Brendan was that his mother's ambition, I think, was that he would be a lawyer. And he was apprenticed to a lawyer before he had finished his school. He had done some work with a legal practice in Ennis. But I think his father would have had the agenda that he really wanted somebody to come into the hotel business. So after he finished school, he worked for a former hotelier who ran the Gresham in Dublin later, Toddy O'Sullivan. And then he went off for the best part of a year's training in the south of Germany, in the Bavarian Alps.
Okay, I mean, this is Germany in the 1930s, right? Mm. I mean, did he have anything to say about Nazi Germany?
Oh, he had a lot to say about Nazi Germany. Well, he told one story, which has been repeated several times, that a group of brown shirts came into the hotel one night and they all saluted and said, Heil Hitler. And despite the family background being common and Gael, he immediately replied, Heil De Valera. And they were apparently coming across the counter to what they were going to do with him, and the owner intervened and said, no, it was only a joke. Anyway, he got away with it, but he told that story several times. But he also would have spoken about the fact he, Bavaria and the southern part of Germany was Catholic, very Catholic, and was more anti-Hitler than northern Germany. So he would have been very conscious of conflict between the church, and that they were deliberately, there would have been parades of brown shirts when masses were on, making noise and rackets outside the church. So there was a lot of conflict between the Catholic Church and the Nazis at that particular time.
Andrew, can I just move on to you then about, you know, his early formation in hotel management, right? He was involved in the family business, later in the Stevens Green Hotel. What I'm getting at here is his personality. I mean, you'd be the man in the best position to tell us about that. His ability as a networker. So how did he operate?
So you asked about serial entrepreneurship, or was there a gene in the family? Well, it may not have gone through all generations, let's put it that way. But I think that what himself and James both had was a very strong sense of internationalism. And that allowed them to be very entrepreneurial in their approach. In terms of the hotel and his background and learning as a hotelier, it seems to me that gave him a very strong sense of that businesses are built on people, and that people had to be treated with respect, and staff needed to know that what they were doing was central to the future of the business, and that what they were doing was central to a wider community. So those human skills, I think he learned. On reflection, I think his rearing in Six Mile Bridge obviously gave him a very strong sense of people in the locality and what their interests and needs and the pressures that were on them. But I think that the how that translates into management and leading people and so on and networking people with people was strongly grounded in his experience as a hotelier.
Now, in the course of his work then up in the St. Stephen's Green Club, he met Sean Lamass. Now, is this another one of those fortuitous accidents, just like the family coming into the ownership of the hotel, you know? Did he ever talk about that, about meeting Lamass for the first time, and, you know, how did he get on with him?
He was brought into Stephen's Green Club because it was in some financial difficulties. So he used...
So he was a troubleshooter in that sense.
He was a troubleshooter in that sense.
Yeah.
And he...
Can I just say, he's in his mid-20s at this stage. He's a very young man.
He's very young. Yeah. But then he had an international hotel experience that perhaps very few in the country had. So he was able to turn around the finances of that relatively quickly. And I think it was very much based on a tight eye to the costings of the catering there, and improved the meals there. And it was in that wider context, I think, that he became known to Lamass. I'm not sure if his first real face-to-face contact with Lamass, and Brian, maybe you know more on this, wasn't at the base interview for the post.
But I mean, I understand he was appointed. There was no interviews.
No, there was no interview, but he was the person who approached him, who was the secretary, head of one of the departments responsible for aviation within the Department of Industry and Commerce, was later to work with him when he was in Bord Fáilte. But he has clear memories. He's talked about remembering Lamass playing poker, memories of Lamass playing poker in the Stephen's Green Club late at night. Mm. Lamass was fond of cards.
Yes.
Lamass would have known him, and he would have known Lamass, no doubt about it, but when he was in the Stephen's Green Club.
Okay, so as a result of that, he's appointed head of catering in Foynes, right? Which was the flying boat terminal at that time, just 1942. Una, can I bring you in here? Because I want you to talk a bit about Foynes and later Shannon as a window on the world, especially the United States. So how important is that in our story here? I mean, what were American perceptions of Ireland at this time? How important was tourism?
I'm not sure that tourism was important in Ireland in that sense at all. But Foynes is the very first stop from America to Europe at that particular time. It's the most significant transatlantic stopping point between 1944, from 1945 on until Shannon, of course, in that instance. But one of the things that's really important is the concept of Ireland or the idea of Ireland in America. There was initially a very poor version of Irish people in the United States after the famine. You know, they were dirty, they were criminal, they were threatening, they were Catholic. All of those things ran together into a something that was not of that republic. Whereas by about, you know, the 1880s, 1900, what the Irish Americans were trying to do is to redeem that image, to try and bring that image to something that was respectable. And you see that a lot. Sheet music, for example, and John McCormack would be going over and back to sing. I think 1.5 million copies of The Last Rose of Summer was sold in America alone. But the sheet music for that had shamrocks, green, cottages, beautiful young girls, Irish colleens, which is kind of interesting in the concept of what we see afterwards. But also you see George M. Cohan singing Yankee Doodle Dandy. So he's both American and Irish, and he comes to Killarney to learn an Irish accent. You have just Tenor, well, of course, which is not quite the same. there's a sense of hospitality, even in vaudeville songs. You know, you're welcome every evening at Maggie Murphy's home. So that sense of hospitality is very much there in America. And even vaudeville, Maggie Klein, who was probably the biggest Irish American star in vaudeville, she's there with boxing, throw him down, McCluskey, and everybody is singing the same song. So there's a perception of Ireland there. And Al Smith runs for president in 1928 and doesn't get it, even though we focus very much on JFK. So what we're seeing, I suppose, in lots of ways, is the Irish-American image of Ireland is predominant. And one of the things that's really interesting is that in that green space, as the historian Marion Casey says, she says, you couldn't let the Irish take control of that. And so, for example, even when, for example, EI is the offshoot of GE and it comes to Ireland first, it's called the Emerald Isle. But of course, Lammas doesn't want to call it that because it seems that it's an Irish American thing. So that therefore becomes the EI company. And I know there are representatives of EI there today, so please don't contradict me. But also, when you see, I think, this sense of the knowledge of a contemporary Ireland is not something that's really hugely significant in the United States. So what was authentic? For example, the Clancy brothers go on the Ed Sullivan Show in 1961 and their Brooklyn manager tells them, wear an iron jersey. So they put on their iron jumpers and 7,000 iron jumpers are sold amongst the United States. So you have that sense. Now, you also have, of course, in Ireland, the notion of emigration, the notion of unemployment, and this contrasts very much with Foynes and Shannon. So you have a number of things. You have things that are concentrated in Foynes and Shannon. You have the welcoming images that's really important. You have hospitality. You have the sense that here on your doorstep when you arrive into Foynes or arrive into Shannon is the real Ireland. And so therefore you have this green space, which is made in America in some ways, but capitalized on in Ireland. And I think one of the things that comes out of Brian's book is that after a particular St. Patrick's Day, Brendan O'Regan gets a call from, I think it's McCarthy, the guy who eventually builds the Shannon Shamrock Hotel. So think about that. He said, I want to do something. So it's after St. Patrick's Day in the United States. It's called the Shannon Shamrock. So you have all of those elements coming together through the person of Brendan O'Regan. And I think that specific focus on tourism, on advertising, on bringing the passengers in is the real focus here.
Now, speaking of hospitality, let's go on to the first area of controversy here. Did he or did he not, along with Joe Sheridan, invent Irish coffee? Because I wandered into a bar in San Francisco called the Buena Vista. And they claimed, I nearly thrown out the place actually when I objected. Anyway, they claimed that they were the originators of this. What's the story here, Brian? Can you shed any light on this?
Yes, no, in doing the book, I was fortunate in Foynes to interview one of the live witnesses whose account didn't differ from other ones I would have heard previously. First of all, coffee had been strengthened up with whiskey for hundreds of years or whatever before there was any invention of a thing called Irish coffee. And the concept of Irish coffee isn't putting whiskey into coffee. The concept was driven by Brendan was demanding the top standards from his staff. And shortly before, maybe it was the week before, if you like, the invention of Irish coffee, he'd given Joe Sheridan a very hard time because he was sending out a duck to a very important a plate with a duck.
So just who was Joe Sheridan?
Joe Sheridan was a chef in Foynes. Right. Apologies, chef in Foynes. He was sending out a duck to a very important one of the guests. And Brendan grabbed a bunch of red berries and he put it on the duck and said, wait now, that's much better. Look at it now. It's got eye appeal. Yeah, we have standards here to keep up. We have to have the best tasting food, the best looking food. So shortly after that, and this wasn't the first time whiskey had been put into coffee in Foynes, a flight came back that I think may have, there's different stories about the flight, whether it had gone as distance or come back. But anyway, all the passengers were very cold and everyone rushed. And Joe Sheridan had the idea that instead of doing something, he would make something that would look like a Guinness. The key to Irish coffee is the fact that it's in glass and there's a head on it. That's what makes Irish coffee different from just pouring whiskey into coffee. So there was the sweet, the mixture, the sugar, the coffee, the whole thing. And that was presented to them. And the next morning, and it got a wonderful reception. And the next morning, it was brought in and Sheridan put it proudly in front of a Regan. Now there's an Irish coffee, etc. And that's the story, which I've believed. I haven't heard it told differently. And that was from one of the Finucans, age 95, 96. She's passed on since, that I interviewed about 6-7 years ago in Foynes.
Well, I can tell you now, when I worked as a barman, just after my leaving cert as a 17-year-old, right? And tour buses of Americans would come in with about 30 or 40, all looking for Irish coffees. I would curse whoever invented this drink.
can I deal with the point about San Francisco?
Okay.
I lived in San Francisco for a few years. Anyway, an American journalist writing for, I think it was the San Francisco Examiner, Stephen Delaplane, who we have lots of photographs of with Brendan, he came into Ireland and he had Irish coffee and he wrote up about it in the San Francisco newspapers. And the Buena Vista bar restaurant in Fisherman's Wharf, San Francisco, thought it was a great idea and they started trying to make it. I use the word trying to make it because they weren't able to get the local cream to stay on the top. It would be all right for a while and then it would dribble down. It would ruin the effect. So they had to come back and there was a lot of liaison back and forth. But eventually they popularized it. We're talking now about the late 40s, 50s. They made it very popular in the United States. So the Buena Vista, if you go there, you might have 16 guys. You'll have a big long counter and they're mass producing Irish coffees.
Okay.
So they had a huge role in popularizing Irish coffee in the United States.
So we'll give them some credit. Right. Now, can I go to you, Sean, because you launched Brian's book back in 2018, and you seem to imply that Brendan O'Regan was kind of your shadow throughout your career. Just talk to us, when did you first come across him? I presume this in the 50s sometime.
He stalked me all my life.
Right.
We moved, my father was appointed school inspector in County Clare in 1954. We moved to live in Ennis. We lived on Bindon Street, and our back garden adjoined Springfield House, the O'Regan's house. So we could literally see him over the fence. But sorry, just to come back briefly to Irish coffee. In 1981, when Ronald Reagan was president of the United States, on his first St. Patrick's Day, he came to the embassy and I hosted lunch there for him. And the lunch, as traditionally these things do, ended up with Irish coffee. President Reagan stood up and said very proudly, "This was invented by my cousin in Shannon." So it may or may not be accurate, but Ronald Reagan believed it. And Ronald Reagan had met Brendan back in the 50s when Ronald Reagan first visited Ireland as... he was actually, he was before he became governor of California. When he was involved in the American Equity or whatever its equivalent is.
That's when he was a union man.
He was a union man, exactly. Yes, exactly. Against all the odds.
Yes.
Anyway, the first time I met him as a young fella was in 1956-57. And... he was a regular visitor in our house because he and my father were in some way, I'm not sure how involved they were in the acquisition and restoration of what became Bunratty Castle. I do remember on one occasion as a young fellow being brought on a drive with the two, with Brendan and my dad, to meet Lord Gort, the seventh Viscount Gort. He, I think, was probably the person who was most influential in the renovation and the acquisition of the castle. But anyway, didn't think much about Brendan until in the 1970s, for 7 years, I was involved in an unusual project for a diplomat. You associate diplomacy with nice cocktail parties and Ferrero chocolates and lovely offices and all of that. And I was the Irish representative in Northern Ireland, if you can imagine that, at a time when we had no office there and when we had no status. So I literally worked out of the boot of my car, traveling around, talking to politicians and community leaders, reporting back to the government in Dublin. And generally speaking, my main ambition was to keep my profile as invisible as possible. Because in the 1970s, as some of you will recall, things in Northern Ireland were probably as bad as they have ever been before or since. And there I was trying to keep my low profile. And one day, this man approached me in a hotel in the Everglades Hotel in Derry. "Oh, Sean," he said, "I'm delighted to meet you. How are you?" And it was Brendan O'Regan. He had just set up what was initially known as Cooperation North. And what he was trying to do was to build up contacts between comparable sectors in both parts of Ireland. And he had come to Derry, in fact, to meet John Hume and to ask John about how he had managed to create such good links between the credit unions, North and South, in Ireland. Anyway, that was my first contact on Northern Ireland with Brendan. For the next 7 years, I met him far more often than I wanted to, because I didn't particularly want to have someone coming to clap me on the shoulders and ask me generally, "And how is the Irish government doing in relation to Northern Ireland?" at a time when I was trying to keep my profile as invisible as possible. Anyway, I moved on then to Washington, 1978. Lo and behold, shortly afterwards, Brendan arrived in the United States. I think there were probably personal reasons why. I think his wife needed to get some sunshine or more sunshine.
Yeah, I think the trip to the United States at that time was really based on the need for funding for Cooperation North, which had been funded for its first 3 years by the Irish banks. And that commitment was, it was really about building a fundraising arm within the US. The piece you're referring to is maybe a few years earlier than that, when as he left Shannon, I got particularly sick. So that was related to not to the States, but to Spain.
All right. Can I hold that discussion for a moment? Yeah. Because we're jumping over the next bit of my script here, which is to look at the whole Shannon free zone and so on. But we'll come back to this, right? I wonder if you bring in you, Frank, here. Before we talk about Shannon, right, the whole concept of the semi-state body, right, which everyone, we think we know what it is that something unique to Ireland? I mean, how would you sum it up, first of all, very briefly, because that's the legal form that the Shannon took.
Right. Okay, so first of all, the term semi-state is something of a misnomer. It really is a fully state-owned entity, but it has some kind of commercial remit. So its debt doesn't lie on the debts of the state itself. It has other source of funding. So these tend to be commercial bodies. The first, they're not at all unique to Ireland. You know, by the time the Irish Free State was established in 1922, already you had the Soviet Union and other communist countries where the economy was entirely state dominated. But what we do know is that when you compare the role of semi-states in the economy of Ireland, it's slightly more slightly greater than in the industrialized world, but much, much less so than in the less industrialized world. So the logic of semi-states is really that they were designed to stimulate economic activity in a way that had already emerged endogenously in the developed countries. Because when we think back to 1922, when the Irish Free State was established, it was, as we know, very much a predominantly agricultural country, as were the newly established states on the eastern peripheries of Europe. These were established around the same time as the Free State, from Finland down through the Baltics, through Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Poland, down to Yugoslavia. Other than Czechoslovakia, these were all also predominantly agricultural economies. So the state stepped in to give a boost to economic development. So that's the origin of the state bodies. And if I might just mention the first three, Cumann na Gael is often regarded as a very much a laissez-faire government, avoiding, you know, domestic intervention in the economy. That really is not the case. The first three semi-state bodies were established by Cumann na Gael in 1927. The most well-known one is, of course, the ESB. So these were pragmatic solutions to difficulties that were raised. The ESB was initially established at Ard na Cruach to generate electricity for distribution. It was thought that the private sector might step in and take care of the distribution because that looked like it might be a commercial proposition. But in fact, the wide, broad dispersion of the population across Ireland meant that it wasn't a commercial proposition. So the ESB was given the mandate both to produce electricity and distribute it. The second semi-state body set up at the same year, 1927, was the Dairy Disposal Company. At the time, the private sector dairy companies, the main headquarters of which is a building you might know in Limerick City, the Condensed Milk Company of Ireland, a beautiful building on the banks of the Shannon in Limerick City, that was the main surviving private sector creamery. It was engaged in a long war of attrition with the cooperatives, and the cooperatives had run out of money and run out of credit, and it looked like they might collapse. So the Cumann na Gael government stepped in and essentially nationalized the private creameries and distributed them over the years and over the decades to the cooperatives. So that was the second one. And the third one was the Agricultural Credit Corporation. And that was designed to address the problems that small farmers and smaller co-ops couldn't get funding from the banks because the only thing they could use as collateral was agricultural land. And as we all know, local communities would have been unwilling to tolerate foreclosure of agricultural lands if they were needed for collateral. So they didn't serve that purpose. So the state stepped in. So the origin of these semi-state bodies lies back in the Cumann na Gael era. So they're pragmatic solutions that weren't at all solely confined to Ireland, but they were overly represented in other developing or predominantly agricultural economies.
Now, I want to move on to the next question, Frank, which is foreign direct investment, right? Because the kind of received narrative is that this all started with Lamass and Whittaker in 1959, and then the Shannon Free Zone was all Brendan O'Regan's idea, right? That's the perceived narrative. What's the reality?
Yes,
notice, by the way, Frank is sitting close to the exit here, right? In preparation for this answer.
So the conventional wisdom that it all began with Lamass and Whittaker is just completely wrong. It is just completely wrong. Whittaker, in fact, and the Department of Finance were very antagonistic to the notion of giving tax breaks to multinationals. And they battled against this well into the Lamass era. So it wasn't a Department of Finance initiative, nor indeed was it a Lamass initiative, because the IDA was established by the first John A. Costello government in 1949. Daniel Morrissey was his Minister for Industry and Commerce. They set up the IDA. I'll go back to the general background in a minute, but the other point to make is that the IDA really got its wings with the export profits tax relief that were introduced in 1956. Again, the Whittaker initiative is 1958. So 1956, under the second inter-party government, the tax breaks that represent the origin of Ireland's low corporation tax regime that we're all familiar with today, that lies with a second inter-party government initiative. So these were inter-party government initiatives. Lamass would perhaps have liked to do something similar, but he couldn't get his proposals through the Department of Finance. What Costello did in 1956 is overrule the Department of Finance objections and say, we're going ahead with these tax breaks. And when Fianna Fáil came back into power in the following year, 57, it ran with the inter-party government initiative. So just the general context then, if I can, might speak for a moment on that. The end of the Second World War in 1945 had seen the transfer of world domination, really, from Britain, had been the major source of foreign direct investment in the world economy. By the end of the war, that role had switched to America. So American capital became available in Europe. So American multinationals started to invest in Europe. This is fantastic for Ireland, because Ireland had always been somewhat suspicious of British multinational investment. There were no such suspicions pertaining to American foreign investment. So immediately the Irish government, and particularly the Department of Industry and Commerce, started to see, how can we get our fair share of this American multinational investment that's flowing into Europe? It proved very difficult because, as has been alluded to already, the image of Ireland in America at that time was of shamrockery and peasants and colleens dancing at crossroads and things like that. It wasn't felt that Ireland had an industrial tradition. So it proved very difficult to attract American multinationals in. And in fact, the IDA policies, their earliest successes were at attracting British and German multinationals into Ireland. And so I perceive the Shannon initiative, or the O'Regan and Lamass initiative, as being in some ways the Fianna Fáil response to the Costello initiatives in setting up the IDA and in introducing export profits tax relief. Lamass felt flustered in some ways when he became Taoiseach that the inter-party government had taken the initiative on that. And so the role of Shannon, and which was, again, about attracting foreign direct investment, but it was separate from the IDA initiatives. So I see that as in some way a Fianna Fáil response, driven obviously by O'Regan, because every initiative requires an entrepreneur to push it through. So I see that as Fianna Fáil's response in some way to the inter-party government initiatives of the earlier on in the decade.
No, but it's interesting what you say there, because it's like, At the high policy macro level, this is the idea of opening up to American investment. And who's the man at the gate? It's Brendan Rice in this area. Like, he's perfectly placed then.
Yeah.
Brian, I mean, how tuned in was he to these developments, like at the higher policy level? I mean, did he appreciate that?
I would have said in the early stages, no. Practically everything Brendan did, he didn't necessarily have any background for. I mean, the comment was made that, the idea of industrial development or export-led companies generating employment and economic growth, that had been arguably floating around since the IDA was set up in 1949. But when the IDA was set up in 1949, it took them 7 years to make their first overseas trip. It took them another couple of years to set up their first overseas office. In other words, the problem was, you might ask, how did such a thing happen? So the missing link here is the Control of Manufactures Acts, 1932-1934. So after there had been a tariff regime under the original Cumann na Gael government, but in 1932, Fianna Fáil accelerated that enormously. And from 1932 to 1939, the number of industrial workers in Ireland increased by 60%. Now, that might seem a very large increase in percentage terms, but of course, in absolute terms, that means it went from 60-odd thousand to about 100,000 by 1939. So in other words, industrial employment in Ireland, manufacturing employment, was very small. And the introduction of the Control of Manufactures Act did have an enormous benefit in that it meant that substitution industries were created in Ireland. You had it was a big boost to the clothing industry. An awful lot of basic materials that we could make in Ireland that were coming overwhelmingly from Britain could now be made in Ireland, because the tariff barriers made it impossible to economically import a whole range of goods from Britain anymore, particularly when they could be manufactured in Ireland. So that created a large support, which was to last, for Fianna Fáil among business sectors of the business community. Ford and Cork had been a substantial, arguably with Guinness, the two biggest manufacturing companies in the country. And Ford had about 7,000 workers for perhaps about this era. But then what they were able to do with the Control of Manufacturers Act is that a whole lot of the materials that needed to go into cars, maybe even be light bulbs, they could be made in Ireland. So the Control of Manufacturers was politically popular, and one could argue it had there was a certainly sound economic sense to it. However, after the war period, and when Europe in the late 40s and then early 50s started to take off and generate industrial jobs that absorbed the surpluses getting out of agriculture everywhere, that wasn't happening in Ireland. And we entered the worst era ever in the early 50s, where our population was falling to the lowest ever point since 1780 or something like that. I mean, mm-hmm. it was appalling.
So let's just go back then to the, I'm just going to call it the Shannon Free Zone. Yeah. I know it's got various names, official names. Whose idea was it? Like, whose initiative was it?
Oh, yeah. So I've gone into the archives looking to answer this. So the first mention that I find in the National Archives of what would later become the Shannon Free Zone is a 1953 minute from the Department of Industry and Commerce that suggests that the Irish government get in touch with the Panamanian embassy in London to explore details of what had happened in Panama, where the Cologne Free Zone had been established. So there's no mention of Brendan O'Regan. That may have been his idea, but there's no mention
quickly,
of it
just,
in there.
Yeah. I'm always anxious, the person at the back of the room, what is a free zone? How is it? What's the concept?
Oh, right. So as has been pointed out there, Ireland was highly protectionist at this time. Imports faced high tariff barriers. A free zone is where imports can be imported completely tariff-free as long as they're then processed and exported out, so they don't pay any tariffs. So it carves out a little free trade zone in what is otherwise an entirely protectionist economy.
Right.
So the first mention, as I say, is in this Industry and Commerce Minute in 1953. And then the Americans, which were influencing economic policy all over Europe at this time, also mentioned to the Irish government, suggested in 1955 that the Irish government should consider setting up an export processing zone. Again, I'm not saying that Brendan O'Regan was not involved in these. He was there in the background, and he may have been feeding these ideas through. But, you know, these ideas were certainly in the ether. And we know O'Regan himself, in the late 1950s, he traveled to Panama and he traveled to Puerto Rico, which has very strong parallels with the Irish case. And there was another free zone that was famous at the time in Hamburg. So these free...
Shannon wasn't the first one.
Shannon wasn't the first one, even though the World Bank, in a major publication of a number of years back, refers to Shannon as being the most significant one. And we do know, and I think you mentioned it in your book, that a future president of China visited Shannon in 1990 and wrote... 1980, okay, yeah. And wrote afterwards, and the leading Chinese economist in Beijing, a guy called Justin Yifu Lin, has a recent book where he mentions the importance of Shannon in influencing the Chinese dual track reform, as it's called, whereby you liberalize certain areas of the economy without dismantling the entire communist era protectionist set of industries, and in that way, That's what's different from, say, the Soviet Union's very dramatic method of reform. So China reformed more slowly, and according to Chinese economists, Shannon played a role in influencing that pattern of Chinese development.
Brian, you want to respond there?
Just a couple of comments on Frank's input there. First of all, In 1953, when people in the department might have been writing these things, this idea of export processing zones or whatever were probably one of the last things on Brendan O'Regan's mind. He wasn't processing. At that stage, he was totally focused on tourism. He was totally focused on the fact that he had created the world's first airport duty-free operation, which had taken off beyond any possible success. So he was focused, that had started in 1951. He was also focused on the drive to improve tourism, because in 1951, within a month of each other, he did two of his 10 major innovations happened within weeks of each other in early 1951. One was the opening of the school here, and the second was the first duty-free shop opening in Shannon. So he was focused on that. So you must appreciate he wasn't an economist. He wasn't somebody looking at national policy. The idea for, and if other people were recommending to investigate Cologne, Brendan has a precise recollection of how he first heard of it. And it was from a man by the name of John Malkin, who was a journalist writing for Air Travel International, a magazine, and who gave him the idea that you should go and see Cologne. And he came out to Brendan's house. His flight was delayed in Shannon, and he got talked, and there was somebody brought him out to Brendan's house in Ennis, and he described sitting by the fire and giving Brendan this idea. Because Brendan at this stage had got the green light from Lamass to set up, to do things, whatever, with no limits, to improve the situation with the airport. Because the big fear was that the jets were going to destroy all the 600 people that were working for him, but it was going to do huge damage to the future of Shannon Airport. And this was, so he went to Cologne and he saw it. Now, to comment as to why both the World Bank and the UN describe Shannon, they refer to it as a processing zone, because there is a difference between the Cologne zone, which is largely logistics. And that was the amount of manufacturing that takes place in Cologne today is very limited. So Cologne is a place where goods are gathered and they're distributed, because it's a unique place to distribute materials from the United States, for example, throughout South America and Central America. Whereas the bulk of the commercial activity, the way Shannon evolved, was that the manufacturing element was adding enormous value, taking raw materials and adding enormous value in and making significant profits in Shannon, which were therefore tax-free. So there's different types. So therefore, the UN and the particularly UN UNIDO and the World Bank tend to give the gold medal for that reason, in that what they set up, particularly in Asia and in Africa, were much more akin to what was happening in Shannon. So that's possibly the reason why.
Una, I want to bring you in here just to kind of zoom back a little bit from the detail of this. How is this affecting the country at large, both here locally and generally? What's happening in the 1960s?
I suppose at the beginning of the 1960s, we think of someone like Lamass, right? And that we change that whole protectionist aspect of the Irish economy into something which is more outward looking, and particularly outward looking to the United States. Now, it's interesting to think in the context of what Frank has said here, that this is a response, because it probably is a response in that sense, that, you know, they'd always said about De Valera that De Valera needed Lamass for the votes, and Lamass needed Lamass needed Dev for the votes, and that Dev needed Lamass to bring the goods. And essentially, this is what Lamass was doing in this sense, maybe as a response, maybe that his time had come. But the bottom line was that he said, there's no point in having political independence unless we can manage emigration and unemployment. And if you take the notion of the jets here in this particular instance, that they were going to now, you know, not have to stop at Shannon, because Shannon, of course, was its most important transatlantic airport, Europe's most important transatlantic airport at that particular time. And in Brendan O'Regan's words, it was the crossroads between Europe and America. So from that point of view, I suppose this notion of consolidation of the economic foundations of political independence is where Lamass was going with this, and to create a viable society. How do you do that? You need to control immigration. You need to control unemployment. So therefore, he was able in some ways, and in some ways that O'Regan gave him this template in Shannon in many ways in the 1960s. This is what we're doing. We can still protect indigenous industry, but we can actually support foreign direct investment in the country, entice foreign firms in to make things that we can export. So from that point of view, those two things are actually, if you think about today nearly, you're actually looking at the same kind of idea in many, many ways. So this template is actually given to him by Shannon, by what O'Regan brings up in Shannon. But it's not just that. O'Regan is kind of looking at a number of things, and tourism was mentioned. You mentioned it here, Brian, that he's saying that tourism, no other industry, he said, can give decentralization like tourism. And he says this in 1957 when he's appointed chair of Bord Fáilte. So the notion that you just wouldn't have investment in cities, in urban areas, but you could have them around the country, this concept of decentralization is something that he was really pushing in this particular instance, particularly with tourism. And of course, the third thing is in a world which is looking outwards, and it's not just looking outwards anymore at Britain, that it's looking outwards, not just, I suppose, at America in his case, but when you think of some of the companies that come into the Shannon Free Zone initially, some of them are from Europe, from Japan. So from that point of view, you're actually looking at the pianos, you're looking at some from Britain as well. Pink comes in from Britain, I suppose, Laninit in many ways. But the other things that we're talking about here, I suppose, is the focus on the individuality as a nation. We're not just any place. We're not any place in any country. We're Irish. And therefore, we need to add some sort of individualism to that, whether that, and that comes, of course, with the notion of Bunratty in particular. And he says we need to stand out in an international world. If we're going to be an open economy, if we're going to be looking outwards as an economy, we still need a USP. And our USP is going to be our individual national identity. And he kind of pushes this along with, well, you'll know more than I do in this instance, since he pushes it along with the notion of industry, of commerce, of economics. And I think those three things are significant in that instance.
Just to remind the audience now that you have to think about your contributions. Anyone in the audience wants to come in, because I'm just keeping an eye on the time here, because the chat is in full flow here. If you want to get it in edgeways. This is a very positive picture so far. So I'm tempted to ask the question, is there anyone in the room here with a bad word to say about Brendan O'Regan?
Oh, I have.
Now's your... Okay, Andrew.
But I honestly won't.
That's okay, Andrew. No, well, what I'm getting at is... And I'll go to Frank here and Brian on this one, is that it wasn't all plain sailing, right? It's not like all these individuals and departments and the IDAs and so on are speaking off the same hymn sheet, Frank.
Yeah.
I mean, Sean, you could give your insights as a, you know, a civil servant, right, dealing with a captain of industry like Brendan. I mean, what I'm getting at is, was he a nightmare to deal with, you know, in relation to established procedure and so on?
For civil servants, yes.
He's long dead, yes. But you can speak freely here. Right? Oh, no, friends.
I had this conversation with Brendan on more than one occasion. He never quite saw that the role of a civil servant was non-entrepreneurial. He preached, which he had heard Lamass talk about. Lamass had spoken to a group of civil servants in 1958 or 59 and said, you've got to become entrepreneurial. And this was Brendan's grist to his mill. I mean, he was basically saying the same thing. My involvement with him, which was in a more complex area of diplomacy, he was helpful because we were approaching the Northern Ireland situation, say, from a top-down approach. In other words, try to get a political settlement which will be negotiated at the top and hope that it will basically sink down and will be acceptable to people on the ground. Whereas Brendan was dealing with the ground, he was, in fact, conveying similar ideas to the ideas that were being bounced at political level. He was doing that at a community level. And in particular, he was doing it at a community level involving people from both parts of Ireland. He had started, I think, with the idea that he would involve himself and his cooperation ideal within Northern Ireland. That's where conversations primarily should be had. But he quickly came to the view, no, it had to be a much broader conversation. So I don't think people like me would have argued with them as much as my colleagues in the Department of Industry and Commerce or the Department of Finance. I asked Ken Whittaker one time. I started my career in the Department of Finance in 1961, and I was in Whittaker's private office. So I knew Whittaker reasonably well and continued to keep in touch with him until he died. But I asked him one time about Brendan, in fact, when this book was being launched. As typical of Whittaker, he hesitated before giving any view at all. And then when I pushed him a bit, he said, well, he wasn't a civil servant. And I said, but he did lots of things locally. I mean, Whitaker acknowledged that. And to be fair, I mean, his view of Brendan was a very positive view. But he could understand how Brendan irritated many of his civil service colleagues. Mm. But I think almost anyone who approaches civil servants with a new idea inevitably will meet that sort of response.
It's part of the dialectics of administration, right? Frank, can you just come back to us? I'm just interested in the differences between the IDA, Department of Finance, and so on, right? You know, what was going on?
Yeah, can I just add to Sean's story, first of all, that when the IDA was first set up, the Department of Finance demanded reassurance from government that its board of directors wasn't going to be, and I quote, a gang of crackpot socialist planners. So, and later on in the first inter-party government, when Sean McBride was Minister for Foreign Affairs, isn't that right? He hired as an economic advisor from outside the civil service, a guy who later lectured me in UCD, Louis Smith, an agricultural economist. And the civil servants were having none of it. So after a few months, they insisted that Louis do an Irish language exam, which he failed. So he was booted out. So civil servants were very careful in guarding their territory. As to the question Tommy asks, there was J.P. Betty was the first director of the IDA, and Betty was worried as soon as the Shannon Free Airport Development Company was established that there was going to be a conflict of clash of interest between the two. And sure enough, that proved to be the case until one time when Donagh O'Malley was... Des O'Malley was Minister for Industry and Commerce and came out of a meeting in New York with a bunch of New York investors to find Shannon Development Company standing outside the door waiting to go in to pitch for the same investment. So after that, Svadko was actually sort of officially demoted and the IDA boosted up in the hierarchy. So the relations between the two of them were reset at that time on the basis of Des O'Malley, who, of course, was a Limerick TD, I think, wasn't he? Yeah.
Cian, you want to come in there?
Okay, Cian O'Carroll is my name. I had the joy and privilege of working in Shannon Development for most of my life. And to kind of respond to the question of whether Brendan O'Regan was popular or not, he was extremely popular among staff because he was all the time preaching creativity and encouraging innovation. I suppose the slightly negative thing was that he hadn't much respect for organizational niceties, and he was very much inclined to cross lines very much. I mean, for example, I worked on the property management side, and I got a call from Brendan O'Regan that two Americans were in his office and they wanted to restore Napoleon Castle. So I went back to my superiors, one being Tom Callan and the other being Paul Quigley. And of course, I told them the story, and they were intensely irritated by this happening. But I said, what do I do? And they both shrugged their shoulders and said, well, you better go ahead. So I got an extra job to do, which lasted quite a few years. But like the Brendan O'Regan had a very unusual management style. It was a little bit like in Oilga, Mullan Thoike, August Chukishe. He had relationships with pretty well everyone in the company in the early days. And I think we have had an analogy that Shannon Development was a bit like a symphony, and that Brendan O'Regan was the composer, and Paul Quigley, who was splendid in organizational terms, that he was the conductor, and you know, so we proceeded. So I think that the an article in the Reader's Digest identified him as the most unforgettable person I ever met. He was a man apart, and I can't think of anyone that I met in my life who was like him or who was so inspiring. And Brian and I had the privilege of getting to know him in later years, and in particularly a recording 10 hours from Brendan of his life and times. And that prompted Brian to come up with the idea of the book. So, Sheena Will.
Thanks very much for that. Brian, you want to come back there on this, the internecine struggles, the different departments?
Yeah, well, I think... I think he, Brendan, the bottom line of what I'm going to say is that I do think he deserves enormous credit for the biggest single element of the two biggest single elements of the Irish economic situation today in terms of turnover, in terms of employment. And that is manufacturing export-led industry and tourism, and particularly American tourism, which is the biggest single component, well, in the last normal year before COVID. The biggest single component of tourism from any one area comes to the United States, and in terms of turnover terms. So in terms of industry, the element that's not perhaps dwelt on, I'm getting back again to the Control of Manufacturers Act 32-34. People were so afraid. The second inter-party government introduced various reliefs, which Frank has referred to earlier. But to a large degree, they were very afraid to go very far with this, because this was politically dangerous. Because 1956, when Lamass was in opposition, he was so utterly scathing about any attempt to touch the Control of Manufacturers Act. The idea that foreigners would run your country didn't make any sense. It wouldn't happen.
So it was politicized.
It was both sides were afraid.
Yeah.
Both government and opposition. Even after the IGA was set up, Lamass then had a big campaign for the 51 election that he was going to abolish it. But because of John Beddy being a schoolmate of his from O'Connell Schools, it survived with some minor modifications. But basically, both parties were afraid of what could happen. And therefore, when Brendan got his original blessing for what was called an unofficial, he was a one-man semi-state body for a year. And that was before Shannon Development had been made into a company. He personally, for no payment of any kind, he personally, with his own operation in sales and catering in Shannon, was given the authority to do whatever he could. He was given the power to do whatever he could to improve the airport in Shannon. And therefore, he started these travels to America to see about getting in American industrialists. He started all of this campaign. And basically, he then went and realized there was the problem with this is that you had to have somebody to sign contracts. So a year later, they formally created a semi-state company with initial capital of 200,000, which was Shannon Free Airport Development Company. And then that company, after a few initial false starts, which I go into detail in the book, he basically then brought in one after the other big successful American companies. And one after the other, they were successful in that they were able to find and train local people in the skills they required for manufacturing. And this was commented on after his retirement by Sean Lamass, that and was ran very much contrary to a major plank of Ken Whittaker's philosophy, which was that you should have industry in Dublin and Cork where there's a tradition of industrial work. What they learned from Shannon was that people who grew up with a farming background where they were used to equipment and things like that had better skills and a better attitude towards working in factories and working in large companies because it was their whole life, their whole social life. So people who went to these new factories, SPS, GE, etc., Laninit and Shannon, De Beers, they socialized with those who were there. They set up sports clubs. This was their life. And they had a genuine interest, which Brendan had himself. They had a genuine interest in the culture. Having a genuine interest in the business was very important. And these companies succeeded. And gradually, based on the success of those companies, I've made the point earlier, I've made it several times, that Lamass then felt quite safe in 1964 in removing forever the Control of Manufacturers Act. There had been some amendments made to it,
But effectively, if you're worried about all the jobs you're going to lose in making mineral water or in clothing, etc., and an awful lot of those jobs did eventually die, a lot of them were affected by EFTA and other things we did later, other arrangements we made in working with and then eventually, obviously, the EU. But you had built up then gradually, and it increased and increased and increased, industrial workers from the new companies. And so therefore, there was no longer a political worry that had faded by the mid-60s. By that time, the new company that only first proper years of exports was 61, by 1965, I think, or 66, manufactured exports from Ireland from Shannon was 31.7%. It peaked at that. Obviously, then a lot of stuff was going elsewhere. And by the early, by 1970, I think it was down to 11%. So the numbers fell. But for it, there was an enormous boost to manufacturing exports came from Shannon in the mid-60s. And Lamass himself, after his retirement, gave extensive interviews in which he highlighted Shannon. And he said that the economic growth in Shannon was wonderful. And not only was it good for the growth there, it gave an example to the rest of the country.
Question there from the front.
Yeah, Vincent Curran, fifth CEO of Shannon of Elwyn, and maybe the last one, although Neil Peake is here, he might dispute that. So I just wanted to go back to the Chinese story, which I think if Brendan is the forgotten man of in terms of Irish economic development, then the China story really is not understood in this country to any great extent. Frank, you're absolutely right. And it's real. It's absolutely real. So in 1980, Jiang Zemin, who would later go on to lead China, came and studied here in Shannon the free zone model. And he took that back and that became the model for the special economic zones. You're on the East Coast and now there's several hundreds. I think there are over 700 now or what, of special economic zones in China. And they are indeed modeled on that. And the proof of that is that many premiers and presidents of China have visited Shannon. And as a development agency, we had many regions that visited Shannon on a yearly basis. But why would the person who was about to become either the most powerful or second most powerful person in the world in his last overseas engagement come to Shannon? I'm talking about Xi Jinping. So Xi Jinping's last international visit is to Ireland. Now, Dublin says it's to Dublin, and we all know here it's to Shannon. What message is he selling to? He's not selling a message to Ireland. The message is to the Chinese people. And the message is, I am a reformer. I am going to continue the economic reforms of China. I will not go back to the days of pure communism. And the message, the way he does that, is the symbolism of visiting where it all started, where that opening up of China happened. Shannon Free Zone. And that was the message. We had, when Xi Jinping came here and I met him, and I have a famous picture for myself of shaking hands with him, which gets me into every Chinese university, which I use shamelessly, may I say, there was 200 TV and radio stations from China in Shannon for that. This is the impact that we've had. But we tend to overlook, as you said, a nation of 4 million people at that stage or whatever it might have been has had a profound impact on the economic development of China. And they became the manufacturing powerhouse of the world based on a model that was developed here. And as Brian rightly says, the model was about added value through manufacturing. That's what differentiated the Shannon Free Zone. That was the model. A geographically distinct area is what they needed. They needed a model that was geographically distinct. So what went on within that geographically distinct area was different to what went on outside that. And that's why they adopted the Shannon Free Zone model. That's why they are the manufacturing powerhouse of the world. And for better or worse, it all started here in the Shannon Free Zone.
There's a question in the back there, yeah?
Yeah, Paul O'Brien. Just somebody talking about O'Regan and what was going on industrially. The tourism thing was going on in the background from the early 50s with O'Regan. But one of the stories that I like best is when a shovel manufacturer, Bernard McDonough, came to Ireland as a result of meeting Ronnie Delaney coming back from the Olympics. He wound up here, looking in Galway to set up a shovel factory. He failed completely. And O'Regan caught him on his way back, going through Shannon, introduced him to Drumoland, which he subsequently bought, developed and built the Clare Inn, the Limerick Inn, and the hotel you had your lunch in, all down to O'Regan's salesmanship.
Right. Now, I tell you, I want to ask, this is presenting Brendan O'Regan as a colossus striding the planet, right? So I'm going to ask you a question, Andrew. Did he become fabulously wealthy as a result of all this enterprise?
I think really that means, did I become fabulously wealthy? Because that's the, I saw that question up and I thought, whoa, that's a bit weird. I think, I don't think it's too far to say that Brendan...
I'm just checking your wallet.
Oh, yeah, it's there, actually. It's there. It's fairly thin. You didn't see it easily, did you? He really wasn't motivated by money. And yeah. If you were to look at the various contracts he worked with the state as a sole trader, that's very evident. And I know that when he finally retired, and the state was looking to identify a salary level for him, he reduced what they were proposing and so on. And so really from about his... When he retired from Shannon, he wasn't in any earning capacity and working full belt the whole time. He just didn't have an interest in money. He understood from his background it had to be made. People had to be secure. And the impact of not... He grew up in a very poor Ireland. Half, you know, people emigrating left, right and centre. He would speak to me about the airport being a source of emigration. And families lining up to say goodbye to people and mothers in tears. So it was a two-way traffic coming out of Shannon. So, no.
He's like a semi-state employee until he retires. And
Well, Brian will disagree with you that he's not.
No, he was always, this is very wrong. He was never a semi-state employee. He was never a state employee, ever. He was a private contractor who had a separate contract with state companies.
Okay.
For which he got a percentage of the profits and he got a very small sum, maybe £1,000 plus a percentage, a small percentage. But he was very much a private enterprise person all his life, even though his work was for the benefit of the state.
No, it's kind of out of fashion these days, like this idea of public service. I mean, my own father, for example, worked in the ESB at, you know, middle management level, you know. And like he definitely... He didn't preach about this, like, but from just talking to him over the years, like, this idea of service for the state, building up the state, like, he was completely opposed to the whole rash of privatization and so on and so forth that happened, you know, has happened since, for good or for ill, you know. But, you know, it's just that in the world today where you see, especially where some of the state companies, I'm thinking of Irish Sugar, you know, were kind of, I don't know, I'm allowed to say this, like, looted by certain individuals, you know. It seems to be something that's out of fashion, you know, and that's something I think we should remember here today, you know, in particular. That's what I'm getting from this.
So can I come back on this, Tommy? I mean, your opening question was really about this idea of a colossus. And if you walk into the Midwest region, boy, are you going to get that in the face. And I think actually that's missing one of the key questions here. For me, at least, one of the key questions is, who was this guy? How did he achieve what he achieved and what was driving him? And those questions get a bit lost in the question of what was actually achieved. And if he was here, yes, everybody likes a little bit of a positive public face, but he would be at pains to emphasize the degree to which this was all done with the staff of Shannon and the staff of elsewhere. And and I think the loyalty that he inspired among that group and quite outside of that, and his ability to persuade and communicate to people was really key here. So he had, frankly, an integrity which I think became well understood by staff in a way. And he made people feel they were part of something bigger. Now, talking about nation builders and those groups, he very much felt that was the case. And if you actually look at the trajectory of his career, that first piece in Foynes is we can do it as well as anybody else.
Yeah.
In fact, we can do it better.
Yeah.
And then that gets shifted into a Shannon context. And then suddenly this kind of widens out. How do we use business, tourism, economy to make Ireland a better place for the people who are in Ireland? And I think that still sits in Shannon as part of the ethos here. And I see the EI reps have gone now, but I'd be pointing to them if they were still here.
No, I mean, just confidence then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so there's two questions that kind of come out of that for me. And one is a kind of a management question, how to manage and lead. And the other is, what is the purpose of an economy and business? Mm. And they get kind of put a little bit aside because you get this kind of person put on a pedestal. While it's perhaps more of a generation we should be thanking for getting us to this piece now. And he just seemed to be able to make it happen he was very resilient. Or he didn't take no for an answer. Is that the same thing?
Yeah, sure. No, yeah, it's interesting because we've been not discussing economics, but we're kind of sliding into ethics here, which is interesting. First time I've heard the two together in a way, you could say. This gentleman here, yeah.
Could I just come to something which I think has not been maybe adequately mentioned? I came here as a young lecturer in 1970, which is about 54 years ago. About a year went after I was here, I got a call. Mr. O'Regan wanted to see me. And it was like, God has summoned you. He was the top man. And when he met me, he said, I've heard good things about you and I want you to undertake a project. But he said, I should tell you from the start, there will be no payment for this exercise. Absolutely no. The only thing you can say to God is, when he says that, is, of course, we don't really want any payment. But what he wanted me and some others to do was to put on a training course for people from third world countries so they could see how duty-free zones and duty-free shops and all of these things could work. He wanted to do this not just for the Irish people, but for the poorest nations of the world. And it went ahead, and I don't know how he funded it, but I mean, that was just, his ambitions were to help humanity at the very widest level. Thank you.
Just talking about the great achievements that Brendan has accomplished in his life, the one thing I met when, I remember by talking to Brendan, through Dorothy here, I felt he was a people's person. He very much involved with the person, how they thought and how you personally can give to your world as such. And I felt that he was a great humanity, a great human person with amazing empathy.
At the 50th anniversary of the college, where President Mary McAleese was there, and I cannot actually remember whether Brendan was there or not, but she referred to Brendan O'Regan. And she used a phrase on Cian Fui, the head down. And what she was basically saying was that was the way Ireland was, and that Brendan O'Regan and maybe other people like him changed that and made people look up.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's just, when I think of my own children, right, today, the biggest difference that I sense from them is the sense of confidence. And this doesn't happen today or yesterday. It's been building, and I think Brendan can be identified as the start of that, as you said, that we can do things just as well, if not better than anybody else, you know. Is there somebody else yet?
Yeah. Yeah, Neil Pakey. Yeah, just looking at it from a global perspective, if I may, for a second. I think Brendan O'Regan has made air travel more affordable. And how's he done that? Because the invention or creation of duty-free means that we are not charging airlines. Well, as airports, we're not charging airlines anything like what we would need to. That passes it through to the consumer. So I think he's actually had an impact on global connectivity through that line. I also think the duty-free industry now is 80 billion euros industry, millions of jobs. You can trace that back to Brendan O'Regan, the size of the global impact the man and his team have had. And, you know, it's just a scale. That's why I'm here. It's like, you know, my goodness, I can write a book about aviation, perhaps, and Brendan O'Regan would feature prominently in it. And I was all really struck by the modesty, because I don't know if he ever realized that the actual global impact that what he was doing, because he was such a devotee to this region. Everything was through the Shannon lens. And I don't know if he ever sort of stood back and think, what is this I've done?
Actually, Sean, just can I bring you in on this, the duty free has been mentioned. How did he link up with Chuck Feeney?
I have no idea where their first meeting was, Brian. Do you know that? Was it here at Shannon Airport?
Possibly. No, it was at Shannon Airport. Because Chuck, I think I covered that. Chuck Feeney, before he really got into airport duty free, was involved. He was very entrepreneurial. So before he got involved with cars, so his first time in Shannon, I believe, was when he was providing cars for American soldiers going back to America, could buy the car here and the car to be delivered, etc. He had a big French guy working with him based here in Shannon. I think that's, and so he would have met Brendan O'Regan then. They would at a certain stage, he got into trouble, Chuck Feeney, financially, you can see from his biography. On that business. And he then realized that he'd got a concession for very low money in Hawaii before the people didn't realize the potential value, because the Japanese were only starting to come out of Japan. This was worth a fortune. And he had to really focus on it. So I think I quote in the book, and I have a lot of the original memorandas. Every time he came through Shannon, Brendan told me that himself and Chuck had made a deal that they would teach each other everything they knew about duty-free airport retailing. And there was an understanding that they wouldn't get in each other's way. So therefore, Brendan's focus was on Ireland and maybe Europe, but certainly not on...
The Treaty of Tordesillas between Spain and Portugal.
Okay. But basically, but what I do have concrete evidence of is the interviews with and the documents that were created when Chuck Feeney came through Shannon. There were two documents that always created. The first document was a record of what Chuck Feeney recommends. So Chuck would walk around the counters. He would make the most minute points about the notices they had on, what they should be charging, the signs they should have, the offers they should make. Very, very detailed stuff. So they'd record all this on one memo. Then the second memo was, how much of what Chuck said can we really afford to do? Or should we do? So there were two separate memorandas. The Ryans, there were two brothers who were working there, and Jack Ryan and his brother Will, they kept, there were records kept for them. And you can read, I've interviewed them and I've read the records as to how much Chuck stuff we can. So there was a very, very close relationship. Other people then would talk about Chuck coming in with his little plastic bag, would sit at the back of the plane, and basically, but himself and Brendan would go off to the corner of the restaurant or whatever, they'd be chatting and in deep conversation. And there's other, there would have been an era where Chuck was then completely had taken off. The business had become enormous. And then they would have linked up then afterwards. Obviously, they would have met and regarding the University of Limerick. They would have met at that time. But then they would have linked up when Brendan got very involved in the piece. Chuck would have come to the conference in Drumoland, where I think we have a photograph of Brendan with Bob Geldof at that. And they would have gone then to some of the, after the fall of the Soviet Union, they would have traveled together to a number of countries in the Baltic states. So there's a photograph, I have one photograph of the two of them in, I think it's Estonia. And they kept it completely under wraps because Dorothy Cantrell and others, I think, travelled, I think it was to Estonia, or the Cooperation Ireland had a trip to one of the Baltic states. And himself and Chuck Feeney were there the same month, but they never told anyone of the group that they were there. But they were photographed together in one of the universities. So they were... they certainly kept in touch, very much, right up to the end. I think they were in touch.
Just question,
thank you, Margaret O'Shaughnessy from Foyne's Flying Boat Museum. I'd just like to comment on something Andrew had said earlier. We did a documentary with RT, and Brendan had a major part in it back in 1989. And at the very end, he had the last word in the documentary. And what he said was that Fines was the first time in an international setting that the Irish could show they could do it as good as anybody else. And that was, he's quoted that. And just to go back to the Irish coffee story, in the early 80s, Liam O'Murrough used to do a program in RT called, I think it was Lifelines or Lifetime, something like that. But he dedicated the program to Brendan. And it's an excellent program. It's on the RT player if anyone wants to see it. And he told about his time in Fines and the Irish coffee story and Joe Sheridan. And actually, when Joe Sheridan applied to Brendan for the job as chef, his application said, "Dear Mr. O'Regan, I'm the man for the job, yours sincerely." And that was his application. And you were very right about the duck, Brian, but it was actually called La Bashida duck because Brendan and all his menus would give clear names to the food. And it was a La Bashida duck that was being prepared when they put the red curtains around it. But on that night, it was extraordinary. When he was finished the program, we all went back to the green room. Tim O'Driscoll, another man very involved in the early days of aviation, was there and quite a few more. And there was great banter going on. And Brendan produced this lovely charcoal portrait of Joe Sheridan that had been done by Joe's brother and given to Brendan. I have no idea how long before that. But there was one of the RT staff going around with a tray of Irish coffees and someone hit off him and the Irish coffee spilt and they went down in the portrait and it's all down along the side of it. But he took it that night and he said, just in case anybody ever disputes it, and he wrote the story on the back of the portrait, which we have in the museum, that it was Brendan or Joe Sheridan in October 1945. Oh, sorry, 43, because a flight had to turn back due to bad weather, which they all had to do if the weather got too bad in the Atlantic. And they were all brought in to give them food and drink. And we have a hologram done on that. But the other thing was, Joe Sheridan was invited by to go to the Bonavista, and we stay in touch with the Bonavista all the time. And he died, and he's buried in Oakland Cemetery outside San Francisco. But there was nothing on his grave. And Brendan got on to friends of his in California called the Staveleys. And he asked them to know what they do. And they did a stone on Joe Sheridan's grave, which to this day is there. And it says, "Here lies," and Brendan told him what to put in it, "Here lies the creator of the world's most famous drink, Irish coffee." And that's what's on the headstone.
Okay. I'm just at the time here. I'm going to wrap up here. I just want to ask one question. Is there a Brendan O'Regan archive? I mean, will scholars in the future be able to go to any particular place?
Yes, there's quite an archive was created in the writing of the book. And we would have got whatever records were available. Andrew would have had the contents of Brendan O'Regan. Brendan O'Regan had set up an office in Newmarket and Fergus in, I think, 1993. So that was about 15 years before he died, with Pauline Taylor as secretary. So there was a lot of records from that time that were shifted to Andrew's place in Dublin. So when I asked to have a look through them, I think Andrew and his wife were very happy that I would take them all. And they're currently available. We've had a lot of work, background work, been doing. Elaine O'Malley, who did all the research with the National Archives for that book, the 6,000 pages were copied in the National Archives. All that work is available. It's been put together. We've had meetings. Kian and Elaine have had meetings with the Shannon Historical Society where they were trying to identify from photographs. They were trying to identify people in Shannon in critical periods. There was a lot of background stuff created before the biography was written.
Yeah.
And all of that, we were trying to find a home for it in the new library in Ennis, but we were late. We had a lot of interest from senior people in Clare County Council, but the design of the library was such they couldn't fit it in. We had earlier discussions with UL that didn't come to anything at the time. There's hope that we might be able to have such an archive in the new library that will be built in Shannon Town. Or the other possibility is there may be a Brendan O'Regan Centre, possibly,
right,
built somewhere in the region. Shannon, Six Mile Bridge, and whatever it might be for the best location, and that it could all be deposited there. So certainly ideally, though, wherever it is deposited, it should be associated with the university, so that people can do work in going through the records. And there's a lot of stuff has been generously given by the O'Regan family, Carmel O'Regan, particularly would have supplied us with a lot of photographs, and we've tried to make sense out of them. There is some material still in UL from the Peace Institute that probably needs to be rescued for such an archive.
John, did you express some disquiet about some of the documents that had been winkled out?
No.
I may have misread your notes from your book launch.
Leave you with one last evidence of Brendan stalking me all my life.
Good, let's hear it.
In 1987, I left the civil service, moved down to work with Tony Ryan and GPA here in Shannon, needed to buy a house, bought a house on the banks of the River Shannon near Killaloe, Ballina. It was my very first night in the house. I had nothing, no furniture, no nothing. I had a sleeping bag and a kettle. Knock at the door. My new next door neighbor turned out to be Brendan O'Regan. And he brought me a bunch of freshly cut daffodils from his own garden, put me in the embarrassing position I didn't even have an empty jam jar into which to put them.
So no Irish coffee.
So I never got away from Brendan.
Listen, guys, I'm going to wrap things up there. I just like to thank our speakers, Frank Barry, Unani Bromale, Sean Donlan, Brian O'Connell, Andrew O'Regan. I'd just like to thank our hosts here at the Shannon College of Hotel Management, Keith on Sound. And finally, I'd just like to thank you, the audience, in particular those people who made a contribution from the floor. And do tell your friends and neighbours, well, friends if you have any, that this will be available on our website next Friday, and it'll be available on other platforms as a podcast, so they needn't miss out. So listen, guys, thanks very much. This is a most interesting, stimulating discussion. Thank you very much.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall.
No payments until fall. With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.